This is the Car Dealer Podcast driven by CarGurus. You want the best return for your advertising budgets, and CarGurus Piston Heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and tell them we sent you.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast. If you haven't listened before, we pick our favourite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me again is founder of Car Dealer Magazine, James Baggett. James, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, John. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What have you been up to?
Well, I know I've been going on about it for a few weeks, but it's Used Car Awards on Monday, so we're doing the final preparations of that for this week. We've been running through the scripts, we've been running through all the presentations, we've been making sure all the table decorations are perfectly polished. I don't do that. And then ready for the awards on Monday. So on Tuesday, we can breathe a sigh of relief and get ready for 2023's awards.
Oh, great. I'm looking forward to it. Yes, busy times. Well, when do we announce the... Well, I suppose we'll be live tweeting the awards as they happen right now, Monday night.
The awards start at 7 p.m. the first half. Then there's dinner. Second half starts about 9:30. So we'll be revealing those live on our social feeds. And then on cardinalmagazine.co.uk, the next morning, all the stories will be up there.
Lovely. Keep your eyes peeled.
Indeed.
So our guest this week is head of automotive at accountancy firm UHY Hacker Young. So certainly knows a few things, or a thing or two, about the financial comings and goings of the motor trade. It's David Kendrick. David, thank you for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad at all. Thanks. Not bad at all.
So David,
there we go. He's in.
I'm straight in there. David, lots of people will know you in the motor trade, but I mean, perhaps for those people that don't, explain how you're involved in it in a day-to-day basis. You're a deal maker, aren't you?
Something like that. I've been called a lot of things, but a deal maker I'll take. So the UHY team do a couple of things in the main. The first one is we look after, as a team, approximately 80 dealer groups. From an audit, accountancy and tax perspective, helping them with year end and financial kind of management. And then the other part, which I'm heavily involved in, which I think is far more exciting, is obviously the M&A in the sector. So the buying and selling of dealerships. So it's busy times.
Give me an idea of how that sort of works then. I mean, what does someone come to you and go, I want to sell my business, can you help? Or is it a case of you go to them and say, we've got so-and-so interested in buying your business? I mean, talk to me about how these deals are constructed.
In the main, it is long-term relationships that we've had with people for a number of years and maybe have helped them shape their business with the objective of an eventual sale. It might be, at the moment, a couple of conversations that we're having are people that have done very well through the COVID period and the last couple of years, and perhaps have made 5 years profit in the last two, and that's brought their retirement plans forward. It can be a kind of a number of scenarios. Other ones, I suppose, are where the manufacturer perhaps encouraging them to look at an exit because they want to consolidate their franchise network. Or it might be, as you say, that we're representing someone who's got an ambitious acquisition strategy and they want someone independent to help them kind of open those doors and negotiate deals off the market. So it's every single situation differs in the main. But we probably spend 60% of our time in the shoes of the vendor, helping them sell the business. And then my colleagues, Paul Daly and Ian McMahon, they typically help people with the acquisition side of things and making sure what the businesses that our clients are looking to buy do what they say on the tin, if that makes sense, from a DD perspective.
And tell me about some of the biggest deals that you've done over the years.
The biggest one we've probably done to date is the sale of Motorline to Marshalls.
Right.
that was pretty big. So we represented the Obi family with their exit to Marshalls, which is obviously now part of Constellation. So that was one of the super deals or mega deals, I guess, post COVID. Working on something pretty big at the moment, but obviously we'll remain quiet on that for now. And that's of a similar size. But yeah, it's not necessarily about the size of the deals, actually. Sometimes the smaller ones can be actually more complex because perhaps the business doesn't have a finance director or an MD that has access to all the information you need. Sometimes the bigger deals can be more straightforward because actually they're really well organized. They've got that kind of board set up and they're used to that kind of corporate governance. So yeah, we kind of look after anything from a single site through to the bigger dealer groups in the country.
That Motorline deal was worth something like 50 million, wasn't it? I can't really remember the exact figure, but I mean, talk to me about what goes into something like that. I mean, how many hours do you have to spend and how many people work on constructing that sort of deal to get it over the line?
Yeah, I think it was a bit more than 50, and there was quite a substantial property portfolio. Yes. That was excluded from the transaction as well. But putting that to one side, I mean, again, without giving a kind of a sat on the fence answer, I think every deal does differ. I mean, typically the process is whereby you put together a very detailed prospectus, which is known as an information memorandum, that almost is a sale brochure. So for a business of Motorline, I think we actually had two prospectuses. We had one specifically for the business, which was probably best part of 100 pages. And then you've got the property portfolio as a separate document, which again, I think there was 52 dealerships in that group. So that was probably, again, another 100-page document. So it's massive. Mm. Probably looking at best part of 2 months' work to pull that together with the team at the business. And then in a normal scenario, what you'd then do is you would confidentially approach an agreed list of prospective acquirers, which may be international businesses, might be existing UK businesses, with or without the manufacturer's involvement at that point. So obviously in the case of Motorline, it was very much done confidentially off market without any manufacturer involvement. And yeah, that's shared with prospective buyers, and offers are invited from there. So yeah, there's a lot of time and effort that goes in. We place an awful lot of time early in the process, getting that document really, really kind of spot on, because actually if you can give prospective buyers the information they need up front, you'll get a much more credible offer rather than giving them a fag packet one-sider on the business and then expecting a credible offer to come out of it. It just creates more questions and answers.
And valuation wise, I mean, what sort of multipliers do we work off in the automotive industry?
Good question. There's a couple of ways of valuing a business. The old school motor dealer valuation methodology has always been balance sheet plus a multiple of PBT. Quite an unsophisticated way of valuing a business, if I'm honest with you, because actually most of the PLCs and certainly the larger groups are actually more interested in return on investment. So what size check am I going to write? And what is the underlying profitability of that business, i.e. how many years is it going to take me to get my money back? Mm-hmm. That PBT plus net assets model doesn't really work from that perspective, but it's been around for the last 22 years I've done it, and still remains a mechanism whereby people value businesses today. The more sophisticated method is what's called on a cash-free, debt-free basis. So it's what's referred to as an enterprise value for the deal. And that is typically a multiple of EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization, i.e. what cash does the business generate on an annual basis. So at the moment, I think probably multiples are coming under a little bit of pressure with some of the uncertainty out there and some of the things that are going on within the OEMs, but probably looking somewhere between 4 times at the lower end and maybe 6-7 times at the upper end from an EV EBITDA multiple perspective. But to be clear, that is not a multiple of EBITDA on top of net assets. That's a completely different mechanism.
Right. Okay. So an EBITDA figure and then times between four and six. I mean, it's still pretty strong, isn't it? I mean, would you say it's a good time to sell your business? You're an owner operator. Is now a time to cash out? You've already mentioned the fact that the industry's had a very boring couple of years. Is now a good time to I mean, I suppose when EBITDA is very going to be very strong, isn't it, off the back of those 2 years? Now must be a good time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think 2021 has been a record year for certainly the majority of the businesses we work with. They've never seen profits like it. 2022 in the main is softer. So you're probably looking on average about 60 to 70% of 2021 in the main is what, again, we're seeing within the people we're talking to. It's the million-dollar question, James. Certain businesses probably are well positioned to look at an exit now. However, it does depend on the brands you've got. It probably depends on what that brand's objectives are for the next few years with regards to agency model. It probably depends on what the vehicle supply coming through for that brand looks like. It depends on your location. It depends on the property you've got and whether it needs any investment in it. I mean, there's so many variables when it comes to, is it the right time? I think there's a number of deals still going. We've obviously seen a bit of a bit of activity over the last kind of 6-8 weeks where there must have been best part of 8 to 10 deals announced. So there's been a real kind of surge of completions going on and announcements, which is great. I think the market still remains pretty buoyant. There's a lot of businesses with an awful lot of cash around them who are wanting to spend that money and get a better return from it than just it being sat in the bank. So that does help. However, I don't think you can get away from the fact that there are a few headwinds around the corner and there is a bit of uncertainty creeping in with the economy and everything else going on there. So, yeah, I guess it's it depends what you've got.
Yeah. Fascinating. I could talk about this all day, John. So we should probably get cracking because otherwise I will just keep questioning poor David.
Yes, and I'm sure more will come up as we go along.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So if you haven't listened before, James and I have chosen our favourite stories from the car dealer website this week. We don't know what each other has chosen, and we're going to have a chat about each one as we go through. At the end, David gets to decide whose stories were the best and who is the winner. If you want to play along, you can tweet at Car Dealer Mag and let us know if you think we've missed any stories this week. Last week, I do believe I might have won again. James is rolling his eyes. But I'm going to be very charitable and let James start because I'm...
No way. No, you can definitely start. I'm not taking your charity.
Okay.
Please continue.
Okay. All right, then. Well, I'm going to start with... we briefly mentioned agency sales there. I'm going to start with the news that Stellantis is delaying their agency model changes. So this applies to Alfa Romeo and... Well, Alfa Romeo DS and their commercial brands. So I assume that's Fiat Commercial and Citroen Commercial, Peugeot Commercial, etc. Vauxhall as well. They've got quite a few, haven't they? So this was due to go ahead. Actually, I can't remember when this was due to go ahead.
Summer next year.
Well,
May next year.
May next year. Well, it's been pushed back to January 2024. This seems to have come as a bit of a surprise to the dealers that it was going to affect. And it sort of pushed it slightly out of line with some other markets in Europe, where DS and Alfa and so on are still going ahead on the 1st of July 2023, it says. And I quote here, "At this time, we will now concentrate our energies on the pilot markets for the new distribution model, which is Austria, Benelux, and Netherlands. For us in the UK, Alfa Romeo, DS Automobiles, and all commercial vehicle brands will new, along with other G7 Europe markets. The contracts will be drawn up first half of next year, etc., etc., etc." It's just interesting to me that this has occurred. Now, is it because Stellantis themselves are not ready, or have they had pushback from dealers? I mean, we have seen a couple of Stellantis dealers disappear in the last
few months, haven't
we? I'm thinking of JCT 600 particularly.
Yeah.
Where has this come from? Is it purely that they are not ready to implement this? Because it requires a lot on the manufacturer's behalf to actually sort all this out, doesn't it? It puts a lot of manpower back in their offices, and maybe they're just not ready. I mean,
the quote that I had from the dealer that I spoke to about this, well, he wasn't named, but said it's the first manufacturer kicking the agency model down the road. And it does look that way, doesn't it? I mean, if you're going to be bringing these new changes in, a lot of the manufacturers are doing it now. Why are they delaying it by 6 months when they're already introducing it on plan in Europe and in summer of next year? One of the points that David made about when we were talking about those valuations, the businesses, is you did mention agency, didn't you, David? What's the market feeling towards agency going forward? I mean, if a dealer represents a brand that is going towards agency model, does that mean they're now worth less?
Good question. I think, again, it does depend on the brand. It's creating an awful lot of uncertainty because actually a lot of the manufacturers have not released what agency actually looks like. So how can you forecast what a future business profitability looks like if you don't know what the margin structure is going to be? Mm. Some are going to full agency. Some are going for this kind of hybrid agency model. Some are looking at involving used cars. Some are excluding used cars. Some manufacturers are going with a handling fee, other manufacturers are going with a percentage of margin. So it's really unknown. I think one thing it has done is just created so much uncertainty. And I think it's fair to say that there aren't a huge amount of dealers that feel it's something that's great, because ultimately the feeling at the moment, certainly from the people we're talking to, is it's a margin grab. So dealers have had a good couple of years. They've been making some cracking margins, and all of a sudden agencies coming in and surprise, surprise, it's going to materially affect that likely margin that they're able to achieve. Now, don't get me wrong, 21, 22 used vehicle, new vehicle margin is extraordinarily high. And we can't forget that wasn't the norm prior. However, again, from some of the conversations we've had and some of the details that we've had shared with us, the old kind of inverted commas norm profitability is still quite a lot higher than where some of the agency proposals are. Now, they do take cost out, and I get that as well. But I think until it settles down, the next couple of years are going to be a very interesting place just to really understand what it actually means and also how it affects vehicle supply. Because what happens when the taps get turned back on at the factory and the vehicles start to flow back into the market? How do you make that happen when you've got dealers on agency agreement? One thing that dealers are very, very good at is shifting the oversupply of metal.
Yeah.
Agency doesn't really work, does it, when you get that? So I'm really intrigued to see how it evolves.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be absolutely fascinating. I think the thing you mentioned there about the fact that nobody really knows and nobody likes uncertainty, and the fact that this has got a lot of that in it, it doesn't bode well. I mean, I think that the way I look at this is manufacturers have looked on at these record profits that dealers have been making over the last couple of years and gone, hang on a minute, we want a little bit of that. And it's brought forward their agency plans. What's your general feeling from dealers? Do you think dealers think agency is a good or bad thing? Because some of the ones we speak to are probably towing a party line, especially when they're doing it on the record. What are you hearing from people when you're chatting to them a little bit more privately? Are they happy with it or not?
I think I've spoken to one CEO that has had a positive view on it out of hundreds and hundreds of conversations.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's... Now, look, there's so many if, buts and maybes at the moment, and uncertainty is never helpful for anybody, so I guess that must be factored into that comment. But I think the current model is not overly complex, and it does seem to work. And I think there's just a feeling that, for whatever reason, one OEM has decided that they want to go down agency, then others have looked at it, and before you know it, everybody's going down it, or certainly a large proportion are. The common comment that I am hearing at the moment is people who are looking at acquiring businesses, those franchises that aren't going down the agency route, should I say, appear to be more attractive and appear to have people more interested in them. So it's going to be interesting to see where the valuation starts to be affected by the fact whether it is an agency model or not. That's the one thing that will be fascinating to watch over the next 12 months.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that is very interesting indeed. John, shall I move on to my one? Okay. So I am going to go with my first story, which came out earlier this week following some rumours on Sunday in the national press about Heading Group and Pendragon. The deal deadline has been extended. This is Heading's bid to acquire Pendragon. It was rumoured in the Sunday Telegraph, I think it was, that actually that deal has been done. The headline said as much. They believe that the Pendragon board is going to recommend the heading deal to shareholders. Obviously, shareholders are going to have to vote on that going through. This is a £400 million bid at 29 pence per share. That's the offer from heading. But one of the other things that came out from the stories at the weekend was actually that possibly We Buy Any Car owner, Constellation Automotive Group, might be interested in putting in a rival bid. And we haven't seen anything to that extent this year, but this week. But that deadline has now been extended to December the 9th for heading, so there is still time. I'm fascinated to hear what David thinks on this one. Do you think that heading deal's done?
I don't know is the honest answer because we're not involved, but I think if I was a betting man, I think there's a real likelihood that that transaction will complete, yeah.
And do you think someone like We Buy Any Car's owner, Constellation, could come in with a rival offer? I mean, not necessarily them, but anybody. Is it too late in the stages to come up with a rival bid?
I don't think it's too late, but I think if you were going to move on it, why would you not have done that already on the basis it's been in the press for some time now? I think there's maybe a little bit of continuity between some of the people involved in the two businesses as well, or historically have been involved. Yeah. So again, there's some internal knowledge there. But yeah, I mean, it highlights going back to valuation, it just highlights the potential undervaluation of these PLCs, and Heading could actually buy themselves a very, very large market share in the UK at a quite substantial discount to some of the other deals that we're seeing.
So, I mean, I'm terrible with maths, but so you have to help me out here. But if Pendragon was going to sell on the open market as a private business, I mean, what do you think they would be worth compared to what they're paying?
I don't know is the honest answer, James, because I've not looked at it. But I do know that when you look at the trading multiples and the price earning multiples that these businesses are trading on, they are typically way under where we're seeing from a trade perspective. So I think I was looking at one yesterday, actually, and I think if you look at a kind of an EV EBITDA basis, I think Virtue was something like sub-3. Which is just staggering when you look at the kind of the quality of the business and the profit it makes and what have you.
Well,
and
just sorry, David, just looking at our Cardia Top 100 list from last year, Pendragon were third with £130 million of EBITDA profit. So just going back to your rough kind of calculation, let's say five times that's £650 million, isn't it? So yeah. Heading are getting a massive bargain, aren't they, by doing it like this?
Yeah, and don't let the kind of the headlines necessarily get in the way of the detail behind it, because obviously there's a lot of other things that need to be taken into account. But yeah, broadly speaking, that's exactly what we're talking about. And to some extent, it does sometimes make the PLCs anti-competitive in a purchasing process, because they can't bid at the same level that a privately owned entrepreneurial business can take a view on something. And if they've got a load of cash around them and they really want to buy something strategic, they can afford, they could pay 10 times if they wanted. It's their money, isn't it? Whereas obviously the listed businesses are under the watchful eye of their shareholders and making sure they get a return. So it's a very, very strange market. But yeah, I think it'd be interesting that obviously Heading have acquired these Mercedes businesses last week as well from MB Retail.
Yeah.
So they've clearly got some appetite to do something substantial in the UK, which... Yeah, a bit of a breath of fresh air and a new entrant, really.
Yeah, do you think then that the other listed dealer groups out there are vulnerable? I mean, could someone? I mean, if this could happen to Pendragon, surely Lookers or Virtue could be ripe for the taking.
You would have thought so, yeah. I mean, Lookers do have a 20% shareholder in Constellation Group.
Yeah.
So actually, Constellation have been quite savvy in what they've done there, because, again, I'm no expert on listed companies and how they can be purchased or not, but I'm led to believe that when you get to a 20% shareholding, you do have a almost a controlling vote. So I don't believe that Lookers can be acquired without Constellation's agreement, which is quite a savvy tactical move, you could argue, to protect against one of their biggest competitors. Virtue, however, I'm amazed that that's not being taken out. I have to say, I think it looks exceptional value. They've got some great businesses within there. It's well run. Yeah, as I say, that just looks a really, really good opportunity. But yeah, Robert tells me his phone's not wrong, so
yeah, I'm sure. Well, is that because it's always turned off?
Well, it's maybe because he's doing press interviews all the time.
Oh, they're amazing. Right, that's my one, John. Over to you.
Okay, I will go with used car prices are still going up in capital letters despite cost of living crisis. So this is a chat I believe someone called James Baggett had with AutoChess. Is this a chat you had with them, or is this from
it was a press release that came out on Monday, and I'll just tell you why. I'm not going to want to hijack your story, but it came out on Monday because there were reports in the national press on Sunday that the used car prices were absolutely crashing. And actually, that was the headline in the Sunday Times. But when you actually read the detail and got down to the Auto Trader quotes, it was anything but that. So it was. I'll let you continue.
Yes. So despite the pressures and cost of living crisis, etc., a look at the price trends so far in November showed average price rises of £300. I believe that's year on year, isn't it, against November last year?
Month on month.
£300 up on October's advertised prices.
Yeah.
So in a way, this is not hugely surprising because we bang on like a broken record about, oh, well, you know, there's not going to be a used car price crash because the supply chain hasn't woken up yet and all this, that and the other. But it's surprising to see things going up by quite that amount, isn't it? I think we expected a plateau. Well, most people, I think, expect a plateau at some stage.
Well, my point on this is I think there's a massive disconnect between what consumers think is happening and what is actually happening. And I mean, I look back at all the comments that we get on our videos about used car prices on social media, the emails that we've received to our generic email address at the bottom of these stories from consumers. They think dealers are having it away and are price gouging and are keeping these prices high, when actually it's market forces that are doing that. There are less new cars being sold. That means there's less used cars in the market, which is putting the prices up of the cars that are actually out there. I mean, I spoke to Neil McHugh as part of this story, director of Snow's Motor Group, and he said exactly that. Car buyers think that prices should be dropping like a stone because of the economy, but the reality is it's still just as hard to get cars and prices are remaining firm, he said. So, I mean, that says it all, doesn't it? It's trying to explain that to consumers, and especially when the national press writes stories like that, and I'm pretty sure this is why Auto Trader pushed out that press release so quickly, mid-month, you know, actually saying what's happening to prices, because they wanted to say, no, it's not all bad. Actually, used car prices are still remaining firm. We've got a chat with Darren Martin in a couple of hours, haven't we, today, which we'll be publishing on Monday, a video chat that I'm going to be doing. And I'm going to be asking him exactly that question. And we'll find out what's happening actually on the trade side, because Darren and CapHBI look at the trade prices, don't they? And Auto Trader, which is what this story is based from, is actually on those advertised prices. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, the only other thing to add is Auto Trader wants to highlight that cars are, we have to remember, a fundamental need and not a discretionary luxury. I mean, there's some, it's not as black and white as that. But yes, fundamentally, people do need cars. They don't necessarily go out and buy one because they fancy it. It's not like a watch or a, you know, some new clothes or whatever.
I think there is some softening in some areas of the market. You know, I spoke to Tom Hartley this week. I spoke to Amari. And they were both saying, actually, at the top end, stuff is softening a little bit, not price wise.
That is surprising, actually.
But demand. But then you've got to think those are the cars that are those luxury purchases that people are buying because they really fancy something. There might be some people at that top end of the market actually thinking, I might just hold on for a little bit, especially if they think prices are going to come down. I don't know, David, what do you think on this one?
It's interesting. One of the questions we ask when we bring in our graduate intakes is, what do they think the average margin on a used vehicle would be? And it's phenomenal the range of answers you get on, I don't know, let's say a 10 grand Ford Focus. Some will say actually they might make a loss, and therefore they're the ones who actually understand the market. Others will tell you $6,000 profit, which wouldn't that be nice? But I think there is a perception, unfortunately, that car dealers make an awful lot of money. They've got these fabulous facilities that you go and visit, and that there's huge margins in these vehicles. But as you rightly say, it's supply and demand. And surely a consumer must understand when you walk into a dealership and get told there's an 18-month waiting list for something, that perhaps you're not going to get a discount on it. Mm. So I just don't see it. I don't see used car prices materially moving either, because again, there's no new vehicle supply, and you need a new vehicle supply to create the used vehicle stock. Mm. So I think our view is that it might soften a little bit. You can't get away from the fact that obviously people are now coming to collect their new cars that have come into stock, and the APR or the PCP payment on a monthly basis is probably materially moved with interest rates. So again, is affordability going to mean that some of the deals fall away? But then you've probably got a short list of other people waiting for that car that you can sell it onto anyway. So undoubtedly it's going to get tougher, but I think prices will remain relatively stagnant.
Yeah, I agree with you. And we've got to remember they went up 30%, didn't they, last year? So yeah, They've got a long way to come down before they even get to those levels that they were pre-pandemic or pre-2021 at least.
Yeah, I agree.
We'll be right back. You want the best return from your advertising budget, and CarGurus Piston Heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market, high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk, and tell them we sent you. Now, let's get back to the quiz.
Right. Shall I move on, John?
Yeah.
I will. So I'm going to go for the story that BMWs are the most expensive used cars to repair, according to Warranty Wise. This is some exclusive data that the warranty company released to us, and saying that the average cost of repair on a BMW in the last 2 years that they paid out on was £1,282. BMW, what they did to create this list is they looked at the top 10 best-selling car manufacturers in the UK so far this year, and then looked at the average cost of repairs for each of those. So we can look at, sort of cross-reference them to how popular these cars are. BMW were top, as I say, most expensive. Audi in second place, with the average cost of repair of £1,164, and Mercedes in third with £992. But interestingly, they also supplied the most expensive repairs that they've paid out on in 2021 and 2022 for those two brands. Have a guess, John Ray, how much the most expensive Mercedes was repaired.
Was it around £23,000?
Very good. You've read my story. Thank you. In second place, BMW, £19,000 payout for one repair. Audi in third, £17,000. I mean, that's going to hurt, isn't it? I mean, what are they repairing for that sort of money?
Not to completely disagree with the reasoning you brought this up, but I thought the more interesting thing is the average repair cost was 1,200 quid, say, for BMW, 1,100 quid for an Audi, 999, so nearly a grand for a Nissan. I thought that's surprising to me that Nissans are effectively nearly the same price average repairs as BMWs, etc. Interestingly, Kia, much cheaper, £646 was the average repair. So
I was surprised at that the fact that they're the averages. I must add, for them to give us this list, they had to at least have paid out on 500 models from that brand. Mm. So it's a half decent sample size. You know, it's pretty big sample size of this.
But what it says to me, because I mean, below Nissan, you've got Ford at 960, VW 892, Toyota 828, et cetera, et cetera. There's not a huge price gulf anymore between the three premium brands at the top and the rest of the volume market underneath. And what that would suggest to me is that the volume market has, you know, there was once upon a time where if you went and bought a used BMW 7 Series or something, everyone you know would go, ooh, you know, look forward to your next service, or, you know, that's going to cost you if that's that brake. Yeah. I mean, the thing is now everything is the same. Everyone's in the same boat, aren't they? Okay, so your, I don't know, Toyota Auris or whatever might not have massaging seats or something like a Mercedes S-Class does. But if the sat-nav breaks, probably it's not that far off the same costs as the screen in a BMW or anything else, is it? So the cost of repair for all cars is kind of going up, I would say, across the board.
The other list in this story that sort of piqued my attention was we just listed the top 10 registrations for the manufacturer, who basically has sold the most cars so far to the end of October this year. Mm. And it's just how low these figures are compared to what they used to be. Ford with 108,000 units so far this year. I remember, you know, rewind the clock back a few years, they were up at 250. I mean, I'm pretty sure they closed in on 300,000 one year. Mm. I mean, especially, you know, during those peak registrations. It shows, doesn't it, just that's the top 10, quite how depressed the market has been this year in terms of supply.
Mm. It does show the ones who are struggling with supply as well, doesn't it? Particularly, you know,
yeah,
Kia 89,000 against Ford's 108. Kia have very rapidly jumped up the chart.
Yeah,
because I don't think they've been suffering quite so badly, have they? Whereas Ford, as we know, have really struggled with Fiestas, which is the, you know, like the one car they sell apart from the Puma.
David, what did you think of those repair costs? You obviously look at the after sales revenue these dealers are making all the time. £1,200 for a BMW average repair sound about right to you?
It's like everything, though. The cost of everything's going up, isn't it? And whilst it sounds a lot of money, did it not used to be £3 to buy a pint?
Yeah.
And now it's about £6 plus. And did it not used to be £4 to get your haircut? Well, I used to get my haircut anyway. I don't have much left. But in all seriousness, you now pay £20 to get your haircut. So I don't know. Sometimes I think we do live in the world of just not accepting that prices do rise with inflation and what have you. And it goes back to the point. Are dealers delivering record profitability by charging excessive costs for repairs and what have you? I think they've got to keep on their game because the authorised repairer market is pretty active and will happily take it on, and customers still go back. So whilst the numbers do appear high, I think clearly the consumer is willing to pay those figures, and it's not coming through in whopping profitability from after sales facilities. It goes back to the overhead that they're operating from, the cost of labour, the cost of materials, the cost of opening the doors on things. So I think it's just life.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely. Right, that's my one, John. What was my one? Yeah, it was my one.
It was your one. Yes. Okay. I am going to go for an interesting story, which is a used car dealer. This is Motorpoint in Swansea. Have been slammed in the national press for taking a customer's car on a 22-mile quote school run.
Yes.
Not our words. So effectively, this is a lady bought a Ford Fiesta from Motorpoint. There was something wrong with it. She returned it for repairs, I think, to the airbags, with a dash cam in it. So you can see where this is going. The dash cam was turned off, but as in your lovely new Ford Fiesta, you've got the Ford Pass Connect app or whatever it's called, where effectively you can see where your car is, which is, you know, you pretty much get these on every new car now, don't you? There's an app or something to see where it is. And, you know, while it was in the garage, while it was being repaired, she was keeping an eye on where exactly it ended up. And she was surprised to find that it had not stayed overnight at the garage at Motorpoint. It had found its way to somebody's driveway. And then the next morning, it appeared to be used for a school run. So it was driven to a school and then back again. So this buyer wasn't too impressed by this, so raised this point with Motorpoint. I think there were some few other issues as well. It came back a bit dented, supposedly, and slightly dirty and all this, that, and the other.
Mm.
Motorpoint, to their credit, have really gone to town with an apology to the point where they bought the car back as a gesture of goodwill. I mean, that's quite a gesture of goodwill, isn't it? Either that or it was worth more the week after they pulled it back and they got quite a deal, which is a possibility. I mean, their argument from this is that, you know, cars do need test driving when there's a fault that, you know, say there's an intermittent fault and noise when you're driving it, you need to go and drive it to find out where this noise is coming from. They can't just put it up on a ramp and poke everything until it makes the noise. And as part of that, sometimes they will integrate this test drive kind of diagnostic with somebody's journey home from Motorpoint or whatever. So a mechanic might take it home or whatever. So they dispute this this particular narrative of events, as they call it. But what I thought was quite interesting is obviously, like, we see lots of for quite a while, there were loads of stories in the national press about I dropped my car off at Heathrow Airport and it went on a 300-mile drive and I've got the dash cam footage to prove it and this, that, and the other. And the same thing was happening with mechanics. There's now seems to be a policy of turning the dash cam off, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it?
But I mean, you know, from Motorpoint's point of view, they don't want their employees recorded while they're doing work. It's a bit weird, isn't it? The interesting thing for me is this app, and that we don't really realize it, but all of these cars are being tracked by an owner if they want to. And also, once an owner sold you a car, there's nothing to say that app has been disconnected, which is a slight security worry. So I just thought it was quite interesting that it came to light because of this, because we've not heard much about the GPS black boxy type stuff having an impact on these.
I mean, it is a cracking story. And the thing that really sticks out for me is Motorpoint's response. I think they did exactly the right thing and just went, we'll buy that car back and we'll pay you the money. It will cover all the costs. We'll buy the car back. Even if it's not true. You know, I mean, I think they are refuting some of the things that these allegations. But if you're going to be hauled over the coals in the sun, that is the best thing to do, isn't it? Just buy the car back. Hand over all the money. Nobody can argue with that. Go, well, actually, fair play to them. They've sorted that out. I think that's, I mean, that is some positive PR for them there from what is quite a negative story. But they did the right thing to put the thing right. Don't know, what's your take on it, David?
Yeah, it's quite an amusing one, isn't it? You can see how these things happen, can't you? I'm sure it happens more than once. I remember once when my car went in for a service and someone said to me, oh, were you out drinking on Thursday night in the local village? And I was like, no, my car's in for service, actually. And obviously someone had gone home in it. But that was many years ago before the tracking was on vehicles. But you are right. It's the day and age we live in now. Everything is being tracked, whether it's on your phone or your vehicle or what have you. But I think you're right. I think, look, they've acted in the right way. They've resolved it and sorted it out. And I'm sure there's two sides to every story with these things, isn't there?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Right, should I go for one?
Yes.
Well, I thought long and hard about whether to bring this one up or not, because it is rather complicated, but I am going to talk about it anyway, because it has been our most popular story of the week by a long, long way. I think about 50,000 people have read this story now. And this is about used car dealer Goffin Motors. Appeared on BBC's Morning Live. They now do a sort of watchdog section with Matt Allwright, who had been investigating these two dealers over the course of 2 days. It was like a two-part of this. The first piece came out on Monday and was all about this dealer called CVF Rochdale. Now, this dealer had sold a number of cars with outstanding finance on them, sold them on to customers, and not paid those finance agreements off, which caused the owners of these new cars serious problems. I mean, one of the owners who spoke to the BBC and featured in the program was pulled over by six police cars on the M6 because a stolen marker had been put on the car. She bought it in good faith from this dealer, CVF Rochdale, and she ended up having the car confiscated from her. She had to continue paying the finance agreement that she had taken out, and this person that sold the car to CVF Rochdale was also paying for it. So there were two people were paying for the car finance agreement while the two finance companies argued over who actually owned it. I mean, quite how that can happen, I really have no idea.
Did the second finance company not?
No, I mean, there's clearly been some mistakes there, hasn't there? Some processes haven't been followed, but CVF Rochdale were absolutely rightly so hauled over the coals. This happened, this unpaid finance of used cars happened to about 10 or 12 customers. That company has now gone into administration and been liquidated. But out of the ashes, as Matt Allwright described it, was this what he described as phoenixing, where one company's burned to the ground and another rises from the ashes. Matt Allwright does like his descriptions, doesn't he? And this new company called Gotham Motors was started up, I think, in exactly the same premises. It was started up by one of the directors of CVF Rochdale and the sales manager who worked for CVF Rochdale, a guy called Phil Manicolo, moved over to Gotham Motors. That director left Gotham Motors earlier this year. Stick with me, it is worth it, this story. That director left Gotham Motors, and because he owed Phil Manicolo 5 months' worth of salary, and some expenses, he handed over ownership of Gotham Motors to Phil. Obviously, when the BBC started investigating this story, they found that this new business had been set up. So they headed to Gotham Motors with their undercover cameras. You can watch this still on BBC iPlayer, Morning Live, Monday and Tuesday. Worth looking at. They headed to this dealership and they found a couple of cars in the showroom were still being sold with outstanding finance on them. Now, I thought, right, I saw this story come out. I saw this dealer haul through the coals, did a bit of investigation, found that they're still trading. And I thought I'd just give him a call. So I ended up speaking to Phil on the phone. And he told me that the feature was highly edited, as in his words. And actually, those two cars that were in the showroom at the time, one of them was on sale and return from a friend of his with outstanding finance on it. But he knew about that. And another one, the finance had been paid off, but it was just waiting for the HPI and the database to be updated. That was what he said. But as you can imagine, when the BBC found that there were these cars with outstanding finance in the showroom, following what had happened with CVF Rochdale before, he got quite a lot of grief from Matt Allwright and the team there, until such a time that the valeter, Phil's valeter, lost his temper and threw them all out, which obviously makes fantastic TV and a great headline for Car Dealer magazine. But it was it was quite a sorry tale, to be honest with you. Clearly some horrible things have gone on in the past, and it's been dragged over to this to this new business. They've sort of been tarred with the same brush. He says that they're not selling these cars with outstanding finance on, and had those right justifications that we've published, and the BBC were sort of alleging otherwise. But it just shows you that you have to be very, very careful with what you're doing. And this dealer, I think he got dragged into a little bit, and he was sort of the fool guy for what had happened before. It just wasn't dealt with very well when the BBC turned up with their cameras. But it's well worth going back and having a look at that morning live show from earlier this week, because it didn't make for pretty viewing. Off the back of it, Auto Trader rang us up and said they're actually going to be terminating their account. And Lamborghini sent us a statement saying that their legal department has got involved because they had Lamborghini logos on the wall. And there was some Aston Martin ones clearly on display too. So it's not looking good there, is it? I brought it up because it was quite an interesting story, just how it all happened, and just shows you that, you know, the motor trade is still very much under the spotlight from the consumer press, especially the BBC. I think this is the third time this year we've seen a dealer on one of these sorts of shows.
Yes, usually it's Cazoo or similar, isn't it? Which we obviously take no pleasure in reporting.
Of course.
But yeah, I mean, we talked about this, didn't we, when you were writing the story. And I think we were trying to establish if there is a slight misunderstanding sometimes from the consumer mass media, as you might say, as to all that, how complicated these things are. You know, like if you run a finance check on a car, sometimes it will come back saying there is finance, but it might be a stocking loan, you know. But does BBC Watchdog or whatever they are understand the difference between that and outstanding finance? You know, and there's nothing wrong with selling a car with outstanding finance on it, presumably. It's, you know, if you are a private seller, if I was going to sell my car with outstanding finance on it, I'm not going to pay that off until I've had the money, am I? So it's sort of
But you just, I mean, this the thing that I couldn't quite understand, I mean, perhaps David knows, is like, where's the obligation to pay off that finance? You know, I mean, and is there sort of an element of trust there that the dealer is going to do it?
Mm.
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, it's something that happens all the time, but clearly this dealer was CVF Rochdale was in trouble and decided that for cash flow reasons it wouldn't pay off the finance. I mean, is it an element of trust, David? I mean,
I'm not sure the legalities of it, but yeah, morally you would think that there's a legal obligation to settle that finance, wouldn't you? Mm. And I guess the paperwork to back it up, but I mean, it's not something you'd check, is it? I think you just go into a dealership and you do genuinely just trust it's going to be dealt with, and you take your new car off with you as you go. And
yeah,
the good old days of when you used to sell a car on the drive and you go and spend £18 doing your own HBI check just to make sure it was cleared.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty immediate, I have to say, once it's been paid off, that it showed up on these checks, I have to say. But I might be proven wrong on that, but you would have thought technology these days would allow you to see it pretty damn quickly.
Yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you? I mean, you can see how these consumers get caught out, because you go into a dealership and you probably, I mean, the chances of doing an HBI check of a car in a dealership, I don't think I would do one.
Well, I did one on the car we bought, which of course had outstanding finance, but it was a Toyota GB stocking loan or something. So you sort of think, well, but then you're buying it from when you're buying it from a listed dealer group, you don't really worry too much about it, do you? Because you think, well, I can march into, there's a big head office somewhere, I can complain about this. if I find it, they haven't paid it off.
Slightly. But that's the trust, though, isn't it? That's the trust element. You trust them because they're a big dealer group. I mean, this was a small dealer. Perhaps the advice is to consumers that they do an HBI check.
I think there's a difference between a stocking loan and personal finance as well. So obviously dealers will have finance on vehicles, won't they, that they are using to fund their used vehicle inventory. So there's a difference between a stocking loan and a Black Horse personal finance loan that's linked to the ownership of that vehicle and its previous owner.
That's not going to show up on the records, though, is it, a stocking loan?
It does. My HBI check, it says Toyota or TFS, which is Toyota Financial Services for some reason. Stocking loan, and it says it has outstanding finance.
It probably depends on the provider, because some just give you a group policy, which is just a lump of cash that isn't linked to any vehicle. Others actually have it specifically linked vehicle by vehicle.
Right. Interesting. Well, I wanted to bring it up anyway, because it was our most popular story of the week.
I will ask as well, this phrase that he introduced, phoenixing, has he just come up with that, or is that complete nonsense, or is that a genuine thing?
In the corporate world, it is. Yeah. So it's, I guess it's the principle is where one company drops and the phoenix from the flames is the new co that emerges from it, i.e. a new company set up with a very similar profile, but obviously the legacy issues are left behind.
But how do they transfer? I mean, it's a slightly complicated conversation, but how do they transfer assets from one to another? The first one was in administration.
That was their point. If it's part of the liquidation, it has to be dealt with by the administrators. Hmm. So the assets shouldn't pass in any way.
But they should be purchased at fair value from the administrator. So the administrator sits in the middle as the independent, and they have to ensure that they're getting fair value, which if it's a used car business, for example, and there's very little around, if they market it to other people, is there actually any value in that? So therefore, maybe the right answer in that instance was just to sell it to the previous owners who were willing to pay a little bit more than anybody else.
Hmm. Interesting. Right, John, over to you.
I'm not sure if it's my final story because we're running out of time, but I'm going to go with some good news in the world of work, which is that Jaguar Land Rover has offered sacked tech experts the chance to work in the car industry. So this is off the back of it's not been a good news week or month in Silicon Valley and its respective offices around the world, because obviously we've had quite a bit of turmoil at Twitter, shall we say. I think most employees of Twitter are now not employed by Twitter anymore, thanks to the meddlings of Mr. Musk. And then at the same time, Meta, who owns Facebook and whatever else they do, Portal and all these things, had quite a big chunk of redundancies. I'm not quite sure how that came about, but quite a big chunk. It's 1,400 or something staff made redundant. Anyway, JLR who said, well, funnily enough, we are actually looking for quite a few tech employees. So they've offered, I think, I mean, this is a slight drop in the ocean, it's 800 roles across the world as part of their plans to become more data-driven. JLR are investing quite a lot in all this stuff. You know, they've been shouting in recent years about all their new infotainment systems and all this, that and the other. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it is developed in-house, whereas maybe quite a few manufacturers will just outsource it and buy in some tech from a tech company instead. But I thought that was quite good news, and obviously quite good from the PR point of view of JLR.
Well, and the cynic in me says that is probably the reason this came out. You've got to remember Thierry Bolloré, the CEO of Jaguar Land Rover, had resigned only a few days previously. They needed some good news, and this was a great way of getting national headlines and some free job advertising. And it worked perfectly because I saw it in most papers and on many, many websites, including our own brilliant website.
Oh, so well done to the JLR press office
there. Yeah. You've stolen all my stories, so I'm out.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. So in that case, David, is there anything you think we've missed over the last week? Any stories?
No, I think it's pretty comprehensive, that, if I'm honest with you. Enjoyable.
That's what we like to hear. So I'm going to have to ask you, who do you think is the winner?
I'm going to have to stick to my loyalties here, aren't I? And James, unfortunately, brought the heading transaction up. So I'm going to have to go with James, I'm afraid.
Yes. Oh, I finally pulled one back out of the bag. I mean, this has been a long time coming.
Well, you did steal my tactic, which is, you know, appealing to the guest.
Funny, man. You know, I've learned from the master.
Or did I let you have it? Anyway. Right, well, congratulations, James. That was very well earned. Also,
thank you, David.
I didn't really want to talk about all these complicated things, so I'm going to let you do that one while I sip my coffee. Yeah, so all that's left for me to say is thank you to David for judging today. It's been great to have you on.
No, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, let's see what news there is for the remainder of the year, and good luck on Monday with the awards.
Thank you very much.
Finally. And thank you to James for competing and winning. And thank you, everyone else, for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. So make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you're listening on Spotify, don't forget you can swipe up now and vote on who you think won. If you want to check out the stories we've mentioned today, you can click the links in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk, where you'll find those and even more news besides that. Thanks again. And until next time, goodbye.